Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about juvenile justice. It is true that at one time, the American justice system viewed juvenile offenders as youngsters whose crimes were largely the product of their immaturity. But in less than a generation, that view has changed. And today, in almost every state, young people barely in their teens can be tried and punished as adults for a wide range of crimes. The question we want to take up this morning is this: what should we do with teenagers who commit crimes? Our guest for the program is Elizabeth Scott. She is professor of law at Columbia University. She is the co-author, along with Lawrence Steinberg, who teaches psychology at Temple University. She's the co-author of the book Rethinking Juvenile Justice. It's published by the Harvard University Press, in which she and her co-author make this argument that we ought to take a different kind of approach to juvenile offenders. Certainly, they should be held accountable, but we also need to recognize that they are not fully responsible adults. She says that they should be viewed as a special case. No, they're not children, but also we would have to say no, they are not adults. As we talk, questions are welcome, and we certainly encourage people to call in and join in the conversation. We do ask, however, people are brief in their comments, and we ask that so that we can keep things moving and get in as many callers as possible. And please do keep your comments focused on the topic. But otherwise, your participation is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, 333-9455 is the local number, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point, if you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. Professor Scott, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, and you?
I am just fine.
Good. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
I think what I'd like to do here to start is make a context for what we'll be talking about, and say, look at, very quickly to start, look at juvenile justice, let's say at three points, three snapshots. Starting out, say, in the 19th century, before the kind of reforms that led to the juvenile court. So if we go back to that point, say, I don't know what point you want to pick, 1850 or something like that, how would you characterize juvenile justice?
Well, in the 19th century, there really wasn't anything that you would think of as a juvenile justice system or policy. Juveniles who were charged with crimes were pretty much treated like adults. There was a special defense called the infancy defense that a child could raise to show that he wasn't responsible for his crime, something like the insanity defense today. But that defense only applied to children under the age of 14. So there really wasn't, until the end of the 19th century, there was no separate either system or policy for dealing with young offenders. Mm-hmm.
So then we get into this period, say, so it's the end of the 19th, early 20th century. This is a great, in the United States, it's a great period of reform. And juvenile justice as a concept and the idea of the juvenile court comes along.
That's right, yes. Starting in Illinois, actually. The first juvenile court was in Chicago at the end of the 19th century, and it was part of the juvenile justice movement was part of a larger progressive reform movement during that period that included child labor laws and the expansion of public schools, but the juvenile court was very much at the heart of those reforms that were pretty much directed at treating children, including adolescents, differently from adults. Mm-hmm.
Well, was there, say, a key kind of idea or key principle that was built on?
Yes, it was the idea of the juvenile court, the sort of basic concept was that juveniles were not responsible for their crimes, that they were children, and as children should not be treated as criminals, but should be given rehabilitation. There was a lot of confidence, maybe optimism, that children who got involved in criminal activity could be cured through the intervention of the juvenile court. And so the system of juvenile justice was described quite accurately as being based on a rehabilitative model, that we weren't, the goal wasn't to punish kids, but to rehabilitate them.
And then when we move into, say, we're starting to get near the end of the last century, and you can tell me if I'm painting too broad a brush here, it seems that when it came to criminal justice, we came to a point where we essentially, I think, we gave up on the idea that adults could be rehabilitated. But for a while, we were still hanging on to that idea that children, that adolescents, that young people could be rehabilitated. And then it seems we got to the point where we even gave up on the idea that adolescents, that people in their mid to late teens could be rehabilitated.
Yeah, I think that's right. In part, I think the problem was created by the rhetoric of the juvenile court and the reformers, and the notion that young offenders were children didn't sit well with the public when juveniles were committing crime. And so there was a kind of backlash that was created in some large part by increases in juvenile crime in the 1980s, juvenile homicide rates rose and other juvenile crime rates rose, and the reaction was in the political arena was to just ignore any differences that might exist between juveniles and adults, and at least for serious offenses, to treat juveniles as adult criminals.
And it also, I'm sure that was moved along by the fact that there were a number of high-profile cases, got a lot of attention in the media, of young people committing serious crimes, things that we might want to call adult crimes. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but sometimes people use that kind of language. Was it the case that there, if you looked at serious crimes, let's say serious assault, rape, homicide, that the incidence of those crimes committed by adolescents, had it actually gone up? Was there more of it?
Yes. Yeah, that is what happened in the late 1980s. And you're exactly right that there were some really terrible offenses that were very high profile, often homicides, that got a great deal of attention and fueled what you might call a moral panic, a sense that society needs to do something to protect itself from young offenders, which might be very appropriate in response to homicide, but the reforms that took place during that period were much broader and extended to property crimes and drug offenses, as well as to violent crimes. And so the line between the juvenile court and the system that had dealt with most offenders as juveniles and the adult criminal justice system became very blurred.
And what did that mean for the kind of sentences that were being given out for young people at the time?
Well, the sentences increased, both in the juvenile system itself, where juveniles were confined to secure facilities for longer periods of time than had been the case earlier, but particularly for those juveniles who were tried as adults, they were subject to longer sentences than they would have been if they'd been dealt with as juveniles. Mm-hmm.
So we get to a point where we have juveniles who have committed serious crimes. The system looks at them and says, this person is old enough to be responsible for their actions, should be held responsible. We think that it's appropriate to try them as adults and then perhaps give some of the same kind of sentence we would give to someone who was an adult. Now we come to the point where certainly all along some people were questioning that, but it seems now we come to the point where there are more people questioning whether that's the right approach.
That's right. Yes, and I think that there has been a reevaluation of those policies, and that's still going on. My co-author and I, Larry Steinberg, who is a developmental psychologist, an expert in adolescence. First started working on this issue in the mid-1990s as part of an interdisciplinary research group that was created by the MacArthur Foundation to look at how knowledge about adolescent development might be relevant to juvenile crime policy. And so to an extent, the book that we wrote that you described at the beginning is sort of the culmination of our work together on this interdisciplinary research network. So a lot of people were questioning both whether these policies were fair to young offenders, that it's in some of the high-profile cases where very young offenders were sentenced to long sentences in prison, that sort of made people uncomfortable. But there's also a question of whether society was better off with these punitive policies. It's very expensive to send juveniles to secure facilities, and if there are interventions that are less expensive that could be done in the community that would serve the same rehabilitative purpose, then it would make sense to, in terms of the budgets of state legislatures to use those kinds of dispositions.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Elizabeth Scott. She's professor of law at Columbia University. She is the co-author, along with Lauren Steinberg, who's professor of psychology at Temple. They are the co-authors of the book Rethinking Juvenile Justice. It's published by the Harvard University Press that takes a look at some of the things that we've talked about here, how it is that notions of juvenile justice have changed over about the last 100, 150 years or so, and about some of what psychology has to tell us about adolescence and whether that will help us ask this question, should they be fully accountable for their acts? Do they fully understand them? Are they responsible in the way that we consider adults to be responsible? Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about that very issue and what it is that now psychologists have to say about, say, the mind of the adolescent and what exactly is the difference between an adolescent, a child, and adult, particularly what's the difference between the adolescent and the adult?
Well, there are two differences between adolescents and adults that are important to developing policies of responding to their crimes. One is that because of their developmental immaturity, adolescents, as most parents know, often make bad decisions, make decisions that are impulsive, that aren't thought through. Adolescents are more susceptible to peer influence than adults are. They're less likely to look at the long-term consequences of their offenses. They're less likely to perceive risks than are adults. And they're just generally more inclined to engage in risky activities. And because of these different dimensions of psychological development, adolescents actually tend to get more involved in criminal activity than do adults. So that maybe for this reason, it shouldn't be a surprise that age 17 is the peak age for involvement in criminal activity. So you see, if you were looking at a graph, you would see a steep curve peaking at age 17 and then dropping off steeply. So the second thing that tells us is that if a lot of adolescents get involved in criminal activity, but most of them will tend to grow out of it as they mature into adulthood, then it makes sense to respond to their criminal activity in ways that are going to promote the likelihood that they don't just continue as career criminals, but actually come out of the justice system and can make the transition to productive adulthood.
Our number here in Champaign-Urbana for people who would like to participate in our conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, someone in Bloomington. Why don't we bring them in to our conversation? They are on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello. The caller there, Bloomington, Illinois. Well, perhaps they changed their mind. Perhaps they did. Well, in any case, people who in Bloomington or any place else who are listening, if you want to join in on the conversation, that's certainly fine and that's welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. It seems to me that the kind of things that you have talked about, that is the important differences between adolescents and adults, that adolescents often make bad decisions, that they're susceptible to peer influence, that they take risks. They're not very good at looking at long-term consequences. It would seem to me that that should not come as a surprise to anyone. And you would say that, well, that's something that we should have known in 1980 as well as we know that today. Why does it seem that it's taken such a long time for that to penetrate the popular way of thinking, or maybe the way that people in the justice system or politicians think?
Well, I think that in fact in 1980 there was some recognition that that juveniles were different from adults. What happened was that juvenile crime increases, there was a pretty understandable response that they're not as different as the child advocates are describing. Most juveniles are offenders are adolescents and not children, and yet they're often being described as childlike. And as I said earlier, that angered a lot of people, so there was a sort of backlash against that, and just a view that that they are committing adult crimes, as you said earlier. There's a mantra during the 80s and 90s, adult crime, adult time for adult crime, and that what was important was to protect society. And so there was just much less concern about the immaturity of adolescence. There also, I think, was most researchers and observers think that the juvenile offenders were largely perceived to be members of minority groups, and so their youth for some of the mainstream public, their youth and immaturity may have been discounted. what has happened in the last, say, 5 years or so is that there's an increasing recognition that these policies of imposing adult punishment may not, in fact, be the best policies for protecting the public reducing the cost of juvenile crime, that kids who get sent to prison are more likely to come out as career criminals, are more likely to engage in criminal activity again than kids dealt with in the juvenile justice system, and that the cost of the incarceration, as I said before, is really very high. Mm-hmm. In Illinois, for example, there is a program called Redeploy Illinois that provides incentives to counties, to local juvenile courts, to keep juvenile offenders in the county and to put them into community programs rather than sending them to be incarcerated in state facilities. And one of the motivations for that program was that it costs, I think, something like $70,000 a year to keep a juvenile in a secure facility in Illinois, and something like less than $10,000 to put them in community programs.
We have some callers now. Let's go to someone here where we are in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was watching a program on TV the other day, and they were discussing the privatizing of prisons, and they mentioned that the companies that do that such activities, one company, it might have been WAC and HUT, they've since changed their name, I'm not sure of that, but they mentioned that their corporate profits are directly related to the number of people they are in prison. So my question is, do you have an opinion on how influential corporate interests are in longer sentences?
I think that these private programs that are used in the juvenile system, which is what I know about more than the adult system, are very problematic. And as you say, they are their profits are directly dependent on how many juveniles are sent to their facilities. There right now in Pennsylvania, two juvenile court judges are being tried on charges of sending a large number of juveniles to a private program and as part of a deal with the owner of this juvenile program. So I think they're very problematic and not the right direction for juvenile justice policy.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We're at our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest, Elizabeth Scott. She's professor of law at Columbia University, and she's the co-author, along with Lawrence Steinberg, who's distinguished university professor of psychology at Temple. They're the co-authors of the book Rethinking Juvenile Justice. It is published by the Harvard University Press and takes a look at how it is we have thought about young offenders and the idea that we should think of them and the place that they are, their psychological development, in a different way than we have, and certainly acknowledge the fact that while indeed they may not be children, that they are not adults, and that it would make a lot more sense. It would benefit them. It would actually be more cost-effective if we thought differently about what it is we do with them rather than to incarcerate them in the way that we have. That's sort of the essential idea. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, and a toll-free, 800-222-9455. You know, I wanted to ask you to react to something, and it might be something that if I had the opportunity to ask your co-author might be a little bit more appropriate for him, but I want to ask you. It was not very long ago here on this program we were talking with somebody about the significant numbers of individuals, and here we were talking about adults, who are incarcerated who are mentally ill. And here is a story that has just appeared a couple of weeks ago. It was reported by the New York Times and looking at juveniles. It takes a look at the issue and finds that something like two-thirds of the country's juvenile inmates have at least one mental illness. And in the conclusion of the article here, are definitely more in need of therapy than they are in need of punishment.
No, that is a very important issue in juvenile justice, and I think one thing that we can take from those figures is that mental illness is a really important component of juvenile criminal activity. Juveniles are much more likely to get treatment in the juvenile system than in the adult system. My colleague Tom Grisso, who is also a part of the MacArthur Research Network, has developed a screening instrument to detect mental illness that is given to every juvenile coming into into intake or into the juvenile facilities in many states. And so I think the juvenile system has, not in every state, but in many states, the reality that many kids suffer from mental illness is very much a part of the awareness of people in the system, and they're trying to deal with that, and that is much less true in the adult system.
So it sounds like that the ideal program for a young offender would be something that it has to address the security concerns of the community, obviously, but also has to address the needs of the individual. That might be some very wide combination of various kinds of counseling at various levels, education at various levels, maybe even the need for the individual to be re-socialized in a sense. This is something that sounds like it's a lot more complicated than doing something where you're putting somebody in a secure facility. Maybe the services that you provide are there, maybe they're minimal, but this is a very different kind of thing.
Yes, and the juvenile system is much more likely to provide those services and to provide a context in which juveniles can receive the services they need that can make it as possible as it can be that they can develop into healthy adults. But as you say, they need educational services. They need they often need mental health services. They need counselors and staff who understand adolescent development. Lots of juvenile systems don't provide that, but it's much more likely to happen in the juvenile system than in the adult. And it is complicated. There's no question about that. In many states, a juvenile in the adult system has no right to educational services, even though a minor who's not in the justice system would have a right to education at that age.
Let's talk with someone else. Someone calling from Indiana. This is someone on cell phone, so we'll go there. Line 4. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I am a psychologist and an educator of 32 years, and I also volunteer in a woman's prison. And my question is, as I understand it, addiction, be it alcohol or drugs, slows down or virtually stops psychological and emotional development. So how does this relate to adults and adolescents that are addicted. At what point do they get to the point that they are actually responsible as adults?
Well, addiction and alcohol and drug use is certainly an important component of criminal activity for both adults and juveniles, and it certainly can impair decision making. I'm not quite sure I have an answer for the question. With juveniles, there is an important policy focus on providing treatment for addiction. That's the impairment that's caused by addiction, of course, is separate, but compounds the impairment in decision making that is simply a part of normal development. I'm not sure I have any a better answer than that.
Thank you. I'm on my way at this very moment to visit a woman that I've been visiting for six years now. She has been incarcerated since she was 15 years old, and she's now 47.
Wow.
Her mother gave her heroin as a 12th birthday present. And so she was addicted from a very young age.
Yes.
And has now been clean and sober for about 20 years. She's been incarcerated longer than that, but her sobriety is that long. And yet I still see quite a lot of emotional immaturity and psychological immaturity with her. Even though she's gotten several college degrees and has gotten, mental growth, I have not seen the psychological growth that I would assume, I would expect to see in a 47-year-old.
Well,
I don't know what. Go ahead.
It sounds like you think that is a result of the addiction.
I would think that the addiction may be part of it. I'm not sure it is. That was why I asked the question. I think there are a lot of factors. There was a lot of early childhood abuse. There was then being incarcerated as an adult virtually from the time she was 15, off and on.
I mean, your description of this woman raises an important point, which is that there are adult criminals who make immature decisions, and to some extent, adults who are getting involved in criminal activity may very well may be making decisions like adolescents.
Right.
But at some point, we attribute that to their character, to who they are, rather than to development. That
yes.
we draw a line as a society, and take the position that at some age you're going to be treated as responsible for your behavior, and if you're unfortunate enough to have a character that is immature and that leads you to make bad decisions, that can no longer be mitigating of responsibility.
I understand that, yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's our local number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do have the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and our guest with the program is Elizabeth Scott. She's a professor of law at Columbia University. She's the co-author of the book Rethinking Juvenile Justice, published by the Harvard University Press. It seems to me that this also maybe suggests that there's another kind of difficulty here. As far as the law is concerned, you like to draw a sharp, bright line between adolescence and adulthood. And for that matter, we might like to think we could draw a line between childhood and adolescence, but it's very difficult to do. And you have to say that often there's no really clear relationship, or there's not necessarily a clear relationship between a person's chronological age and their emotional, psychological age.
Well, that's right, and there's a lot of individual variation in development, so that as we were just saying, there may be adults who are very immature in their decision making. Some of whom may just be late developers, and on the other hand, there may be children or young adolescents more likely who are relatively mature, and so. It's not, we can't draw lines that will perfectly separate adults from adolescents or children from adolescents, but the law creates categories always, so that's what law is about, is creating categories, and the best we can do is to try to create a category that at least conforms to the developmental reality of adolescence. The way we in the book respond to the problem of variation is that we take the position that children age 14 and under are predictably, most children in that category are too young to be ever dealt with as adults, so that should be the minimum age of adult jurisdiction in the criminal justice system, that between the ages of 15 and 17, there might be some instances in which a juvenile is a violent recidivist in which it may be necessary to try that juvenile as an adult on the basis of an individualized decision, and that over age 18, even though there may be some individuals who are immature, that society has to draw a line, and that that individuals should be treated as adults at that age.
Does this require, clearly it's going to require some different kind of thinking, but I wonder whether this would actually require a different kind of juvenile justice system than the one that we have.
Now, that is the system to some extent in many states. Mm-hmm. So that in at least until recently, the categories in most states included a minimum age of adult jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. That age has gone up. Gone down. Mm-hmm. So that whereas 20 years ago, age 15 was the minimum age at which a juvenile could be tried as adults, today it's lower than that, either across the board or for specific offenses. So that a juvenile charged with murder in many states, a 10-year-old can be tried as adults. And then under the traditional approach, which some states still have, there was this kind of intermediate category in which a juvenile could be transferred from juvenile court to adult court on the basis of the seriousness of the offense and the juvenile record and the juvenile's amenability to treatment, and then an age at which there was just a categorical treating of the individual as an adult. So that in Illinois, the age, the line of jurisdiction between juvenile court status and adult status right now, I believe, is 17. Mm-hmm. And was changed recently for misdemeanors to be 18. The other thing that has happened in as a part of the punitive reforms that we describe in the book is that a system of automatic transfer has been enacted by many states, so that if you're charged with armed robbery in some states and are age 15 or over, you are by definition treated as an adult. So there's no individualized decision that juvenile should be dealt with in the juvenile court or the adult court.
Is there some place in the if I say you obviously have in your mind something of what would be an ideal system for treating youthful offenders? Is there any place in the country where they get anywhere close to what would be your idea of the ideal system?
Well, the state of Missouri has a system that is very much admired, and that other states have modeled parts of their programs on. Missouri uses a lot of community-based programs. It has a low recidivism rate, using much less incarceration than Illinois, for example, and it's, you know, that is often viewed as a model system. But many states are examining their juvenile justice systems and looking for ways to respond more effectively to juvenile crime, including Illinois.
One of the things that you point out here in the book is that, in fact, there have been some people for some time now who have been unhappy with the juvenile court system, but their response would be not to try to improve it, but to try to get rid of it. I mean, they essentially think that there should really be just one system, and that there should not be a special system for juveniles and special treatment, that they should be just treated by one entire system. And here in the book, you and your co-author make this argument for that being a bad idea and saying, no, we really do still need the juvenile system. In short, what's your argument for saying that's certainly not the way to go, is to just fold everybody into one system?
Well, the most interesting argument for having a unitary system is made by a few scholars who are not punitive, who think that a unitary system would be better for juveniles. Barry Feld at the University of Minnesota is the leading proponent of a unitary justice system, and his view is that that juveniles get the worst of both worlds. They don't get treatment in the juvenile system, and they don't get the kind of procedural protections that adult defendants get. So even though juveniles are entitled to attorneys in juvenile court, after a famous 1967 Supreme Court opinion, the juvenile court cases, in Feld's view, are not treated as seriously as adult criminal cases, and juvenile court judges don't have the same kind of attitude toward rigorous procedural protections of defendants that adult court judges have. Our response to that is that there's no reason to believe that under a unitary system that juveniles would be better off, and certainly no reason to believe that the adult correctional system would provide the kind of setting, developmental setting that we think is necessary to have a hope that juveniles. That juveniles in the justice system are going to develop into non-criminal adults. Mm. So we just think it's any hope that there could be programs in the adult system for juveniles, which Feld argues is too optimistic, and that juveniles would be folded into a system in which they are more likely to come out as criminals than in keeping a separate system. Mm-hmm.
And just very quickly, one other point, just to make sure people understand how you're thinking about this, you would say that there might and probably are cases where it would be appropriate for a juvenile to be tried as an adult. You're not saying that that should never happen.
Oh, no. No. We recognize that the in order for a separate juvenile system to be viable, there has to be a response to juveniles who are violent offenders who aren't rehabilitated after one crime. And so we on our view, the problem with the traditional juvenile court was that it didn't pay enough attention to society's interest in public safety. So in some ways, we're trying to sort of thread the way between the traditional juvenile court and a policy that treats juveniles as adults, by recognizing that public safety is an important concern, but also that public safety can be accommodated by keeping most juveniles in the juvenile system.
All right, let's take another caller here, someone here in Champaign County, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to return to that panic response that you mentioned that predominantly was in the 80s, though I guess bills like S1 are reflected that through that whole period of time. The time was, even sometime later, there was this discourse about super predators and biological tendencies towards violence and all of this stuff. And most of it seemed to me to have a real strong racial subtext. So I'm wondering whether you'd comment on that again. You know, you mentioned it in passing. But then also, do you have at your in your book or in your database the statistics on how much differential treatment of minorities exists? You know, how many more beyond what you would expect because of just the number of cases go to adult adjudication as opposed to any kind of juvenile? And I guess that pretty much gets it for me, so I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, the claim that that juvenile offenders were super predators was made by a criminologist, John DiUlio, in the mid 1990s, and it sort of captured the as your caller said, the moral panic surrounding juvenile crime that juveniles were on the streets committing murder and mayhem, that they had no moral conscience. And what DiUlio claimed was that in the next generation, the juveniles in sort of after the turn of the 21st century, the problem would get much worse and no city in America would be safe. At least that was the implication. That is pretty characteristic of what really could be characterized as an hysteria about juvenile crime. Now, DiUlio himself has expressed regret for creating that term and for describing juveniles offenders in that way, and acknowledge that his dire predictions have not come to pass, that in fact juvenile crime declined for about a decade beginning in the mid-90s. So one of the reasons we thought this was a good time to write our book and to put our ideas out in the political arena is that there seems to be a period of some calm about juvenile crime. Mm. About what is known as disproportionate minority confinement, there is no question that Latinos and African Americans and other juveniles who are members of other minority groups are disproportionately represented in in the juvenile system and particularly in the adult criminal justice system, and the efforts to understand why that is and how much it reflects bias on the part of decision makers, from the police to courts to correctional facility decision makers, how much it reflects a difference in criminal behavior. This is the subject of a great deal of research, and I think that the view of many people is that there is some of both, that there may be differential rates of offending, that some minority youth may be more involved in criminal activity than non-minority youth, and that there is also a different response to minority youth that may result in disproportionate confinement in the justice system.
Well, we're going to have to stop at that point because we're here at the end of the time. I'm sure it's a subject we'll be discussing again, but for the moment, if you'd like to read more, look for the book that we've been talking about. The title is Rethinking Juvenile Justice. It is published by the Harvard University Press, co-authored by our guest, Elizabeth Scott. She is professor of law at Columbia University. And Professor Scott, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.